Hello, everyone. This is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. Honestly, the really cool thing about this podcast is that I get to talk to people about issues that affect me deeply. Like, when will we finally live on the moon or on Mars, or whether that will happen at all? Because space is not particularly well disposed towards us, as we all know. As if the journey wasn't challenging enough, the effort we have to make to protect ourselves permanently from cosmic radiation is simply ginormous. This once again raises the question, so what's the point in the first place? But no one here is interested in this question, right? Because I assume that you out there are just as keen to watch people explore the solar system as I am. And that's what this podcast is for. And I promise you that I spare no expense or effort to track down the right people with the right answers. So today, I have with me the president of the International Astronautical Federation, chancellor of the International Space University, and former director of Germany's Research Center for Aeronautics and Space. Some people obviously have it in them with careers.
Lovely to be on the show.
Welcome, Pascal Ehrenfreund. She holds many degrees, believe me. Astrobiology and astrophysics are among them. She has worked with JPL, NASA, among others, and was allowed to put her name on asteroid 9826 as a sort of bonus on top. And our topic today, life in space and what is the probability that we will find something out there anytime soon. And of course, as you already know from me, now and then we drift off into the strangest corners of our human minds. Now, let's just begin and see where the journey takes us, okay? Have fun, beautiful space nerds. I know you'll like it that way. And off we go. Is there life in space? Yes or no?
Well, obviously we know that there is life on Earth. But we have not detected any kind of life signature yet. But there are many space missions on the way in order to explore moons and planets in our solar system. And I think the most important object in our solar system to search for life is Mars.
Why is that? I mean, like, Mars has been of interest ever since antiquity. And that is particularly interesting. Why have humans always had this craving for Mars, and why was Mars always connected, even before the technical equipment was around, with life? Why is that?
Well, Mars is our neighboring planet. So no other known planet is as similar to Earth as Mars. And when we explore Mars, we get also really insights into the formation of our solar system. So it's geologically diverse, has an atmosphere. We have found water, in particular in the form of ice and probably underground. And Mars is still the most important object in our solar system for the search of life, also because Mars is particularly close and we can reach it in every 26 months when it is rather close to Earth. We can launch and then target space missions to Mars. And I think we know, or we have the feeling that Mars has been habitable in its early development. It had a similar evolution as Earth. It had a denser atmosphere than it has today. It had high temperatures, likely higher temperatures, and there was probably water on the surface. We know that today, Mars is cold, dry, and not habitable on the surface. And we really want to find life, and we will be only able to find life under the surface. Scientists are really hopeful that life exists in niches underground and that we can still track them down, namely track down remnants of life. And there has been recent evidence.
Like what?
Yeah, so there has been recent evidence of the presence of organic compounds on Mars through the NASA Curiosity rover. There is instruments which have shown the presence of carbon chains, carbon rings, molecules which are carbon-based. It's not life, but we know that there is some kind of carbon chemistry going on. If it is delivered by meteorites or formed on Mars, that is something which we have to find out in the future. But when you also look with other instruments, for instance, like the NASA Curiosity rover did in the Gale crater, it had definitely shown that this environment, the Gale crater, was habitable around 3.5 billion years ago. And we want to go to regions on Mars which have good chances that we discover life, like, for instance, now the Perseverance rover.
We've been very inventive when it comes to picturing extraterrestrial life. Usually it's like the little green man. But to a scientist, what do you picture life to be in a different place?
Well, I'm a scientist and I actually have worked on the topic of astrobiology for a long, long time. And I'm searching for primitive life or for raw material for life. I have been in particular involved in studies and also in space missions looking for life on Mars, particular ExoMars, which is not yet launched, but will be launched soon. And so I am actually looking for primitive life or microbes. And this is already difficult enough. We can, of course, then further go into more or less also the search for intelligent life. But I would like a little bit to explain that it is not a very simple to look for life on another planet because we need a lot of very good instrumentation. And we are looking actually for organic molecules and for raw material. And we have to build instruments which are able actually to trace some of those really important molecules. Some of those molecules are known to everybody. These are amino acids. Amino acids are more or less building up proteins in our cells, and they are a very common component in cells. And so this is one of the main targets of instrumentation. But there are also other molecules we are looking for. And the instruments which we are actually, you know, sending and preparing for Mars, they're actually really targeting life as we know it, simple molecules which actually inhabit our cells.
But in fact, you're looking for something that is known to us. So you're looking for some sort of life we're used to observing. So could there be another form of life also we may not be aware of? Or does life look like the same all over the place because there's just one way to see and build life?
Well, this is a very difficult question because when we are preparing space missions, when we are looking for life in our solar system, we are looking for life as we know it, based on carbon. And it is very, very difficult to look for life as we don't know it. Obviously, there are possibilities that life could be adapted to many different environments, but we are still more or less targeting the same genetic structure, probably with different atoms, you know, replacing mm-hmm. carbon by sulfur or nitrogen. But we are still always looking for life as we know it, and we can build only instruments which are looking at this carbon chemistry which we know from Earth. So it is obviously there is a a whole philosophical in a world out there, how life could be. Is there another intelligent species in the universe? But if it comes down to space missions, which are prepared over years, sometimes decades, we have to be really sure that we know what we are looking for and what we can detect. And then everything gets a little bit restricted.
A personal question to you as a scientist and also as a human being, would you love to see the discovery of extraterrestrial life, or rather not see it? Because the discovery of extraterrestrial life would remove us humans from a very exclusive place in the universe.
Oh, no. I am a scientist. I really, really want to discover life everywhere where it is possible. So I think this is something really exciting. It will provide us with insights into which conditions are essential for life. And of course, it will raise a lot of new questions. So I think also for other people, not only scientists, when we detect life, even if it is primitive life, people will be fascinated, and it will outweigh, you know, fears and risk factors, which are probably discussed, because I think people are just fascinated and interested in the discovery of extraterrestrial life. But we really have also to prepare for that very moment. And additionally, when we really find the first microbes, for instance, on Mars, that will also change how we perceive space exploration in the future, because we really have to protect, you know, life that has probably originated on another planet or moon in our solar system.
Is there a protocol for the discovery of life? I mean, like, is there like a red telephone, or what's happening if signatures of life are discovered?
Well, there are guidelines. They have been discussed in the literature. And as you know, the SETI Institute, which is looking for intelligent life, has also issued guidelines what to do, who to inform. I think the most important thing is to be sure, you know, scientifically proven, having repeated experiments in order to be really sure what you see and if this is really extraterrestrial life. You have to do a lot of tests, scientific tests and engineering tests. If we are talking about return samples and we are measuring in the lab, we can do many more tests and experiments to verify if that is really extraterrestrial life. So I think it has to be 100% sure before this message is released to the public. And I think then a lot of agencies, even the United Nations, I think have to be informed. And there has to be a way how defined how we communicate that. And it will certainly have some different reactions from the different parts of the world. But I think it will be, actually, it is a positive message, not only for scientists.
Are we closer than, say, decades ago to discovering life? Or is it still up in the air if we discover something or not? Or are we getting closer?
Well, I think the field of astrobiology, which is a very interdisciplinary field, where not only astronomers and biologists work together, as the name says, but also geologists, physicists, meteorologists, chemists, paleontologists, and I'm sure I forget a lot of others, cannot name all of them. They work together, and it's an interdisciplinary research. And as we know, every kind of interdisciplinary research always really brings cutting-edge solutions. So I think the field of you know, origin of life on Earth, but also searching for life elsewhere, has made an incredible jump, you know, in the last 2 decades since we have the research field of astrobiology, because of this interdisciplinary exchange. And of course, this exchange is also translated into how we build instruments and how we build space missions. And I think we are much, much closer. But still, I think it is a very, very difficult task. You know, for instance, when you look at Mars, it is like finding a needle in a haystack. And we have to come to the right place. We have to have the good instruments. That's why it's also very important to have a Mars sample return mission.
Would it be an advantage to see humans instead of robots on such missions, because humans have like a different sensorium for the right places and can do things faster and quicker and more efficient than robots?
Yes. So I can answer this question with a resounding yes. So manned missions have a completely different dimension. Above all, you can take a lot of more technical equipment and infrastructure with you. Then when you're coming back to humans, humans work very fast, they work intuitive, they understand complex problems and how to solve them, and they can do that much more quickly. So in the search for life, to give an example, a trained geologist, he or she can do much, much more, such as, you know, efficiently collect samples from different location, or working with a drill, drilling samples from 2 meter or more depths. So human exploration can also cover much larger areas on the planet, as well as operate in difficult terrain, and bring back also much more samples, which are valuable to Earth. But as a final sentence, I want to say the ideal picture, which we all think about and work on, is the synergy between humans and robots. Because bringing humans to Mars, this is still a big step, because we have to solve a lot of research questions before that actually happens.
Can you walk us through a typical robotic Mars mission? So you mentioned the upcoming ExoMars mission, where you were involved in the life detection instrumentation and in the life marker chip development. So can you walk us through the development of such technology and then how it would be employed on such a mission?
Like we have it now with a Perseverance rover, which is actually now on Mars, and also Curiosity, we can see that you have a lot of different instruments and, of course, also cameras, and which are actually working together in synergy in order to see where to sample, how to sample. And whereas now the Perseverance rover is looking in a very interesting environment, the Jezero crater, with 7 scientific instruments for mineralogy, for looking for organic molecules, and many other topics. ExoMars mission, when it will be launched, hopefully in 2022, will for the first time drill into the subsurface, probably more than a meter, hopefully 2 meters. And as I said before, the surface is very dry. It is very cold, and there is a lot of UV radiation and unpleasant, we'll say, substances, which actually degrade organic molecules and life. So we really want to go deep down into the subsurface. And ExoMars is the first mission which will really drill down in the subsurface and look at samples deep down. I think this is a very important step. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you want to look for small molecules, but ExoMars, the Mars Organic Molecule Analyzer, MOMA instrument, is actually looking for small organic molecules, but it works also with a laser. And with this laser, it can actually fragmentate larger organic pieces. And when we analyze those fragments, we can reconstruct more or less the larger carbonaceous or carbon molecules on Mars, if we find them.
Sure. Can you briefly walk us through a day in the life of such a rover? So let's take, for example, Perseverance, for example. So is I picture that Perseverance is waiting most of the time, doing nothing and waiting for input from Earth, and then it would like roll on for a couple of centimeters and then do its thing and wait for another hour and then do the next thing. So what does a typical day in the life of such a rover look like? Taking in consideration that the Curiosity mission has been going on for 8 years now. I mean, like the overall mission covered on Mars, like, I don't know, 12 kilometers or something like this, or 20. So it must be an extremely slow mission.
Yes. Yes, this is true. So it is taking very long. What you want to imagine is to have, you know, a big mission coming with a lot of astronaut geologists and taking samples very fast and analyzing them.
Taking out the shovel. But that's not happening right now. Of course, which is totally understandable, because you have only one shot and you have to be very careful, because if you get one tire stuck or covered, we've seen that you got your solar panels covered in dust and then a mission is over. So you have to be very careful. So it's completely understandable that those missions take such a long time.
I think, you know, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and NASA, they have really an enormous experience. They have now landed really a lot of missions successfully. I have to say that the last landing was not any more the 7 minutes of terror. It was actually like routine. I don't know if you have watched it, but I found
absolutely.
It was just like, okay, you know.
Yeah.
So we landed.
I had my 2, 9 and 12-year-old daughters right next to me. They were allowed to stay up late. And so we were very excited about what was going on, what was happening, because, I mean, like, anything can happen through those 7 minutes. And the cool thing, I had troubles explaining to my children that everything we were seeing already happened like 15 or 20 minutes before that, because we had that time delay. So when those guys in the control room were jumping up and down celebrating a successful mission, in fact, the mission was long before already successful. So that's the strange thing about such long distance missions.
Yeah, but honestly, also it was a very exciting, you know, of a few weeks, because we had 3 Mars mission. The year of Mars 2021,
yes.
Which were arriving. And I think you always want to know, did they actually succeed? And it was really wonderful that, you know, the Hope Orbiter from the United Arab Emirates and Tianwen-1 from China and the Perseverance rover then finally landed, that all arrived at Mars, and then Perseverance on Mars. And it was... really, I found it very relaxing this year. Yeah?
It's already routine, but say, Pascal, why 2021? Why this window?
Well, because as I said before, we have a constellation that every 26 months we are in a distance, you know, to Mars, where it is very good to launch, where we are closest to Mars. And then we can launch the missions. So all the 3 missions were launched within 2 weeks, July, August 2020, and they all more or less arrive, you know, 7 months later, in February. And we have, of course, the Chinese mission Tianwen-1, which has an orbiter, which is first looking for the perfect landing spot.
Let's zoom out a little and talk a little more about the ingredients of life, about biology, possible biology in space, the necessary chemistry. So what are the main ingredients for life? What do we need to build up life?
Well, we have we need, of course, organic molecules. We need a solvent, which we assume to be water as one of the best. And we need an energy source. And so these are the more or less the primitive ingredients. But when we imagine, you know, how actually life originated on Earth, we have to see how was our early Earth. Our solar system and planet Earth were formed about 4.5 billion years ago. And the origin of life on Earth remains a really important but still unsolved question. So we need these chemical raw materials. They are necessary for the development of life. But when we look at the early Earth, there were only a few materials. So few minerals and also very few organic molecules on the early Earth. So we need to have an environment with energy input where chemical reactions actually can create organic molecules. In environments, for instance, like oceans or in volcanic regions. But there's one other source of organic molecules and organic material. In the first 700 million years of our young Earth, comets, asteroids, and also their fragments, which we know as meteorites, have really frequently impacted the young Earth, of course also other planets, and they more or less brought with them water and very likely also prebiotic material. And that could actually be a part of the raw material for life. So I think this is an important chapter, and that also relates to the fact that we have a lot of space missions to small bodies of our solar system, namely comets and asteroids. We want to understand their composition because we think that they have actually brought important raw material for life to the early planets.
When I was a kid, I read a book about the Uri Miller experiments. I think it was back in the 1950s. And I found it really compelling. Those guys, those researchers, they tried to recreate a primordial soup and recreate life in a vat, in a sealed bottle. Was that of any interest for science? Has that produced any results? Or how do you see that now after a couple of decades of research?
Well, I have actually been really so lucky that I did my sabbatical research in the university in San Diego, in the Scripps Institute, where Stanley Miller was still doing research. And
no, you're kidding. Seriously.
Yeah, yeah. So this is really fascinating. I worked with Jeff Bader there. I learned actually how to extract organic material from meteorites.
Wow.
And so this theory, these experiments, they certainly have been one of a kind at that time. The problem is that originally it was believed that the primitive secondary atmosphere of the Earth contained mainly ammonia and methane. And these were the main ingredients of the Miller-Urey experiments. But we know today that very likely the atmosphere was more or less made out of carbon dioxide and also molecular nitrogen. And that would
Pascal,
actually...
could you tell us very briefly what they did back in the day, what they tried to do?
Well, they actually tried to use reducing gases, which, for instance, methane and ammonia, and run them through a discharge in order to simulate events,
lightning
in the atmosphere. And you create a number of complex organic molecules from that. But we know now that the atmosphere did not contain a lot of those reducing gases. And that's why this theory is not anymore so important today, but there was actually samples which were found in the laboratory of Stanley Miller and later on, which actually were simulating volcanic regions. So a lot of this research is still relevant, you know, for volcanic regions on the early Earth.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Even more fascinating that you were, I mean, like you had the opportunity to breathe the air in the vicinity of those guys, even if it turned out to be not the optimal outcome, but still it was a very compelling and interesting experiment that traveled the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was at that time really the primordial soup theory. Yeah.
But you mentioned there was a lot more CO2 in the primordial atmosphere. That could be relevant now on Mars, right? Because the Mars atmosphere is heavily consisting of CO2, right?
The Mars atmosphere is 95.3%, as far as I remember, made of CO2. And generally, the Mars atmosphere and also the Mars surface are not very hostile to life, I would say. So this is why I say that we have really to drill in the subsurface in order to take samples.
So the more CO2 we're blowing up into the air, the more we are turning Earth into Mars.
It is a toxic atmosphere, yeah.
So ever since those Uri Miller experiments, have there been other experiments? Is anyone working on recreating life on Earth in a similar way, just with different gases?
Well, I think we have different communities in astrobiology, and we have a very, very strong community which are looking at the origin of life on Earth, but are really using methods in order to recreate the first cells and also to recreate some kind of raw material for cells. So this is a very big community in order to understand how did the first DNA helix actually form, how do proteins form, and how could they actually be encapsulated into a primitive cell. So this is a very large research community. These are mostly microbiologists, biologists, geneticists, and certainly there are also a lot of scientists looking for life in extreme environments. And that is one of my favorite topics because I actually also still work on that, because we don't actually know everything what's going on our planet. There is still a lot which we don't know, and we always find new species on our own planet where we had actually no idea or we would not assume that they would exist. There was this is always one organism which I am teaching to my students. So just a few years ago, they have detected the devil worm. It's called also Halicephalobus Mephisto, I think, if I said that right. Yeah, Mephisto is easy to remember. Yeah. And it is actually already a little bit a complex organism, which is found, you know, 3 or 4 kilometers below the surface on Earth. So we find so much life on Earth. We find new life forms, which we did not expect. And so still our planet has really, I would say, mysteries. And I think it's important to understand how life thrives in extreme environments on Earth, to understand, you know, where could life actually also reside in our solar system. When we look, for instance, in the outer solar system, we have conditions which could be, you know, good conditions, you know, for life to develop, but there is no sun, there is no light. So they would actually really form in an environment without oxygen, without light. And we know that we find also in regions, dark regions on Earth, microbes. We find microbes everywhere on Earth, in the dry deserts, in the Antarctica, in the deep ocean, in the atmosphere, in the deep subsurface. Wherever we look, we find life on Earth. And that is very fascinating, and that leads us somehow in understanding how we search for life somewhere else in the solar system.
Is it generally possible for life to survive in outer space, in the vacuum, in the very cold places? Would it be possible for life to survive in such places? Or does life need certain circumstances?
Well, what we do, what a lot of the scientific community, which prepares, you know, for future exploration missions, actually does a lot of simulations in the laboratory, but also in the field, as I just described. And so we are testing, you know, organisms, also a particular extreme organisms, under the conditions of Mars. So we expose, you know, microbes, but also organic molecules, because we also want to understand how the raw material actually reacts. We expose them, for instance, to a Martian atmosphere, to very low temperatures, to the diurnal variations of Mars, and to UV radiation. Sometimes each of those components, sometimes all of them. And we look how they react. Do they survive? Can they still grow? Mm-hmm. And this is a really scientific community which is conducting this research, and this is very, very important. And it's not only done for Mars, it is also done, you know, for environments in the outer solar system.
I read that there are certain nematodes that are almost indestructible.
Well, some very funny animals, I think, which everybody knows, are the tardigrades. I think they're also called little water bears. Mm-hmm. And those little water bears, they are able to digest, you know, an enormous amount of radiation.
And, interesting. So they feed on radiation?
No, I don't think they feed, but they don't care. Yeah. And there are many organisms where we see that they can actually really support a lot of radiation. And we know also organisms which can grow, you know, at Mars conditions, even if it's very cold and if they're exposed to CO2 atmosphere. So there are some these experiments are very extended and difficult and complex, but there are already a few candidates where we know that they actually grow. Because it's not only important to know if they survive, we also want to know, can they actually grow?
Hmm. Do you have any ethical concerns when you throw a water bear into the fire?
Well, actually, they do actually survive. And as far as I know, I have never done experiments with water bears. They are microscopic, I have to say. But I have colleagues which told me that they actually, after, you know, a radiation dose, they actually go and feed. They eat.
Interesting.
I think it is important to understand, you know, what are the limits of life. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a very important research for future exploration missions. And not only that, but also for planetary protection. Because mm-hmm. we do not want to contaminate, you know, other planets when we go there with space missions.
How can we make sure that you're not bringing any? I mean, like, humans are not really good when it comes to not leaving their trash everywhere.
Well, there are very, very tough planetary protection protocols, which most of the nations adhere to. The COSPAR, the Committee of Space Research, has actually guidelines which are adhered to by many nations, exactly to where a space mission is going and how it actually has to comply with planetary protection rules. This is not a treaty, but these are guidelines, and they are very openly discussed also among a lot of stakeholders in order not to contaminate. You know that all space probes have to go through a sterilization process according to those guidelines. And it is also clear you don't want to go to Mars with a spacecraft, which actually, you know, has Earth microbes on it, and then you detect life as you have it on Earth. So you really want to be able to detect extraterrestrial life.
So that spacecraft is cleaned before it launches?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Pascal, these days, artificial intelligence comes to the rescue in those places where humans seem to be lacking answers and solutions. Is that also the case when it comes to trying to find answers to the origin of life, for example? Because, I mean, like, artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning is very useful at analyzing large patterns and reverse engineering things like games, like chess, like computer games or whatnot. Is that also already being employed in the search for the origins of life in the first place?
I'm pretty sure that in the chemistry section of astrobiology, that people which are looking at chemistry models, that this is a large amount of data that artificial intelligence plays already a role when you have to go through, you know, an enormous amount of different possibilities. I'm pretty sure. But when I look at artificial intelligence, I know that it will play an important role, you know, when we have space missions. And it starts already to play a role when we have missions to Mars right now. And in particular, also in robotics. Wherever we go, if we actually simulate that on Earth or if we go to other planets, it plays a very, very big role and will play a very important role in autonomy and in operations and also, of course, in the communication with future spacecraft.
On a completely different note, exoplanets have been discovered a couple of years ago for the first time, and now I think we know of about 4,000, more or less. And so far, we have only been able to indirectly see, quote-unquote, those exoplanets because our technology hasn't been developed enough to observe them directly. But to your knowledge, is there a possibility that there's a planet out there that's, I'm not saying teeming with life, but that looks like Earth with oceans and forests and continents and the like. Is there a possibility?
Well, right now, I think with the Kepler mission, as you said, we see or we have identified more than 4,300, I think, exoplanets. Many of them are actually in multiple planet systems like our solar system. And we have many different techniques, you know, looking at you know, radial velocity, at transits, even direct detection is already by removing the light of the star, the planet's orbit. All that is really very dynamic, and we have a lot of space missions also now and in the future. So I think it's a very dynamic field, and it will tell us soon, you know, what are the chances. But I think the Kepler mission has already shown that there is an enormous amount of stars which have planets. And I think the estimates are in our galaxy, the Milky Way, we have approximately 100 billion stars. And there are, I think, 25 billion stars which will have planets. So that's an enormous number. And every time when you talk with statistics, you cannot exclude anything. I think finding life will be most successful when you look at an Earth-like planet orbiting a sun-like star. I think everybody can agree on that, because this is what we can work on the best, because we are in this condition right now. But these vast numbers, you know, of planets, just alone in our galaxy, they let us hope, you know, that something like that actually, that life, at least in a primitive form, has probably originated in a similar way somewhere. I just want to address the non-intelligent to intelligent life. When we look at our planet, Earth, we find microbes, simple microbes, which are very robust already 3.5 billion years ago. So 1 billion years after Earth originated. Mm-hmm. But humans are here approximately 200,000 years. So looking at primitive life, there are a lot of studies which indicate that mm-hmm. primitive life will be easier to find and would be probably more common in the universe.
This is, of course, a little off topic now, but seeing Homo sapiens on this planet for 200,000 years as opposed to 200 million years of dinosaurs. I think it was 200 million years, more or less. I mean, like, we should be a lot more humble as human beings, considering ourselves visitors on this planet. I mean, like, 200,000 years as opposed to 230 million years. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Actually, I kept something on that topic for the espresso.
Yes, you should. We're getting to that. On a completely different note. So thank you for letting us into your world as an astrobiologist, as an astrochemist. By the way, astrobiology is a very, very strange term to me. I mean, like, we're talking about biology in outer space, but we have never seen any kind of biology in outer space. So who came up with that term?
Well, actually, this term came with the astrobiology program by NASA, which was approximately 1996. That was after the detection, you know, of a Martian meteorite, where there was discussion that eventually there could be life, forms mm-hmm. of life that finally was not confirmed. But before that time, we talked about exobiology, which probably fits better to your to your sentence, which you just said. I think that astrobiology got this name because it is not only dealing with how life actually, or if life is present beyond Earth, but it also deals how life has actually originated on Earth, how it developed, how it evolved. It looks at the entire evolution on Earth and in what environment it actually thrives and how it influences the environments and vice versa. And I think that's why it also was called astrobiology.
Okay, makes sense. I understand. I still think that exobiology makes more sense, but no one asks me, of course. Pascal, you have an extremely impressive CV, an extremely vast biography. It's spanning 3 full pages. I printed them out just before our conversation. I have it right in front of me. So what can we learn from you when it comes to making or bringing more gender balance into that field? How high is the price you have to pay for being the first woman in your position right now?
Well, I have to say that I was really interested in science, and I was, for instance, interested in biology and astronomy, and studied both. And I always was driven, by the interest, in order to understand, life in the universe. And it was actually a pleasure. Obviously, all scientists, and that is independent of my own scientific work, scientists don't work from 8 to 4. Yeah, scientists are really, I'm sure you, sometimes we dream of scientific results. We are full of our research, and we cannot stop sometimes on the weekend. And I think there is also a lot of pleasure, which we take in, conducting what we actually really like to do and in our research. So I think it's not such a hard price to pay. I think what is important for a career, which I did, is to be quite flexible. So I actually, as I've seen, I made an additional study later, 10 years after I made my habilitation. I actually studied management in order, to shape more in the space sector, because I had a feeling that scientists are not always heard enough, and I wanted to be able to help and shape, the agenda of the space sector. And there are many steps, in a career which you try to plan, and there are many steps which happen. So I cannot say that I planned every step of my career, and I'm actually really happy what I achieved. It was different, and I had to be flexible. I had to be moving around between countries. I have been working in 2 continents, in 5 different countries, and also partly learning the language. And when you look back, I think it was an amazing time, and there's still time to go in the future. But obviously, you have difficulties. I had space experiments which are actually exploded on the launch pad, and years of work, which have fallen apart. I had space missions which have been heavily delayed, and I had to go through this phase, with my team and my students. So you have ups and downs in this career, but I think the space sector right now also is so dynamic, and is, more or less also driving the non-space sector. It is a wonderful place to be and to work and to thrive and to evolve.
You just mentioned you went through all those ups and downs. Do you have a particular mission you will never forget?
Well, if you have a space experiment which is exploding, that's not very nice. And that happened to
Tell us about that.
That happened to me on a Russian rocket on a bioband facility. In particular, I feel with my students, which have worked on that. But it was reflown, a few years with success. So that helps you. But these experiences which you have to do, I think the experiences which are really burnt, into my heart are when you go on field trips and when you go in extreme regions on Earth. I have been many times in the Atacama Desert, where we actually simulate and test instruments for Mars. And this is when you, live in a tent where it has a -5 degrees in the morning when you wake up, and then it gets 40 degrees plus. And you work and live with your colleagues and try, to prepare a future space missions. And these are experiences which you never forget.
Fascinating. Because you also get to know your colleagues in a way you would never be able to if you were working in an office, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you have to work together to bring the entire infrastructure, to the site. And it's in the middle of nowhere, And you actually have to cook together. You have to prepare instruments under very difficult conditions. You have always strange, you know, things happening, you know, when you are in the middle of nowhere, things which don't work. The generator breaks down, the car breaks down. You have only an Iridium phone to communicate, you know, you go into this nature where nobody has ever been before. You know, the Atacama Desert is an amazing place, very arid. And you are sitting on a peak, and you actually can give this peak a name because nobody has been there before. And of course, you know your colleagues in a very different way because you go through difficult and unusual times. And then once a week, you can go to Antofagasta, you know, this is in Chile, and take a shower, you know, and have an apple martini with your colleagues. And on the next morning, you go back into the sand.
Speaking of naming mountaintops, you have a stellar object named after you. Is that right?
Yes, I have an asteroid. I think 9826. I think Ehrenfreund.
Did you come up with that?
No. This is a number according to a catalog. So it is an honor to get such an object. You cannot choose it. You are happy to get it. And it is a smaller asteroid in the outer asteroid belt. It's approximately 8 kilometer diameter. And I can tell you, I have often to explain myself, it's not dangerous for Earth, yeah? So it is actually in the outer asteroid belt and it does not cross the Earth's orbit, so it's not going to hit the Earth, yeah?
Good news. So why is it named after you?
Because I have been working on the organic chemistry and the composition of comets, asteroids, and meteorites for a long time. I wrote an habilitation with the topic of cosmic dust. And I was one of, you know, a few women at that time which finished the habilitation, particularly on this topic. And it was an honor that I got. It was a recognition for my work in this field. And of course, I'm very proud of it. And I hope that, you know, one stage I can also really observe it when I'm retired.
Wow. Yeah. Are you always looking up to the sky, trying to see it?
No, honestly, you cannot see it. I look at the moon and at the planets. I have telescopes in my garden. I do not look at this object. But I have worked on asteroid missions. And I think, as I said before, we do believe that asteroids have transported water, but also organic molecules to the early Earth, some raw material for the origin of life. And I actually work also on space missions, which look at the more or less at the composition of asteroids. I think that's a very important topic, and we had very exciting space missions just now. Hayabusa 2 actually returned, you know, material to the Earth on 6th of December last year.
That was fascinating. I mean, like, it was a very dramatic mission because they couldn't close the lid after takeoff while on the asteroid, right?
No, that was actually OSIRIS-REx.
Yeah? Ah, yes.
This was OSIRIS-REx. That was a NASA mission, which will only return in 2023. But Hayabusa 2 is already longer in orbit. It took samples from the asteroid Rügi. And when I was still at DLR, DLR prepared a lander, which actually landed on asteroid Rügi and measured some of the surface parameters in a 17-hour mission. And I was actually, you know, at the time, you know, a part of this mission. It was really fascinating, you know, what actually happened in these 18 hours. And there are also really very nice papers which gave, you know, quite of important details on the surface and on the porosity. These are all, you know, scientific results which we want to achieve. And we are, of course, all looking forward to the analysis of the return samples by JAXA and the scientists in Japan.
Could it be that we're seeing signals of life in those samples?
No, we will not see. I don't think that, I'm pretty sure that there are no microbes, but we will find organic molecules very likely, like we, for instance, found on the comet Churyumov, Gerasimenko, with the Rosetta mission. There we found a lot of interesting prebiotic molecules for the first time on the comet nucleus. And these informations are really, really helpful for reconstructing the origin of life on Earth.
Wonderful. Fascinating. Pascal, are you ready for an espresso?
Yes. It's a little bit a summary, I would say, of what we discussed. And you have already mentioned it. So actually, when I teach, I always address the topic that our planet Earth is really unique. And we witness that life on Earth is really ubiquitous, and it has adapted to all extreme conditions we can only imagine. As I already said, we find it in the deep subsurface, in the atmosphere, in the Antarctica, in the hot vents, hydrothermal vents, in the deep sea. Wherever we look, life has manifested itself. So, important is also that we have to take into account that the conditions, the regional conditions, they shape life on Earth, but also that life shapes and changes the regional conditions. And when you think about that, and you think about this complex evolution we had on the planet Earth, you wonder if such processes actually have happened on Earth, which have happened on Earth, can repeat itself on another planet in the universe. And as we discussed before, humans have only been on the forefront of the evolution for about 200,000 years now. It's like a second on the clock of the Earth being 4.5 billion years old. And we have microbes which are here certainly since 3.5 billion years. So how long will we be on this planet, and how do we actually preserve our environment? And I want to remind everybody that our Earth is a really very extraordinary planet, and we have a duty to protect this planet and our environment. And although that has been said a lot, there is no planet B right now.
Right now. It could be different tomorrow. But the good news, Pascal, from what you've been saying about the ubiquity of life on Earth, is that whatever we do, and we're trying hard as humans to destruct the planet, but we will not get rid of life. That's the good news. The only thing we will get rid of is ourselves.
That might be true, but it should not. We should not get that far. You know, we should use science. You know, everybody should really be educated to understand what the important processes is and how special this planet is.
Wonderful. Pascal, thank you so much. It was a great, great pleasure to be spending those 75 minutes with you. That was really, really enlightening and inspiring. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I thank you.
200,000 years versus 200 million years. How puny we are. And yet, we manage so exquisitely to ruin the planet permanently. If the dinosaurs had already done that, we might never have existed. An interesting thought, isn't it? Okay, back to the present. Thanks for being with us today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And if you want to find more about what's happening on the space scene, jump over to Spacewatch Global, the global epicenter of unbiased space news. By the way, Spacewatch.global is now also available on Clubhouse, the new social network. Take a look if you have time. I look forward to next time. And by the way, leave us your messages at podcast@spacewatch.global. We're looking forward to it. See you then. Bye-bye.